Well, good evening. We come back to the book of Daniel, the second chapter. The spotter's got the outlines. If you need one, wave your hand there and he'll hand you one. One of those and didn't get one. But we're continuing the account where we started examining last week. I kind of got in the middle of it, left you hanging, and I'm kind of going to do something similar tonight. Sorry. It's just that this there's too much going on here to try to get it all done tonight, although with the clock static at 10:30, I can go as long as I want. I keep looking at the clock, see what time it is, and it continues to tell me it's 10:30, which isn't going to be helpful this evening. Sorry. You know, before I get started, I probably should back up and tell you something I forgot to tell you this morning, just some updates on a couple of prayer requests. Austin Chavez continues to do quite well at the rehab facility out at the Oaks, recovering from the car accident where he had to have his arm surgically repaired and his pelvis surgically repaired. I was out to see him yesterday, and he's able to stand on his left foot, and they're letting him touch his right toe to the ground to help him keep his balance. Now, they had told him no weight bearing on that leg for 3 months. It's only been 3 weeks. He's not putting weight on it, but he can touch his toe down on it now, and he's excited to be making progress. He's telling me various milestones he's reaching in his exercise and therapy. They will be looking at, they'll be doing another evaluation a week from Tuesday to determine whether or not or how soon they're going to send him home. He may be going home much earlier than they thought. And, of course, that causes Jenny to be somewhat concerned about making sure they're ready for him when he comes home, because he's still going to be getting around the wheelchair. But he's wheeling all over that facility out there in his wheelchair now, just going to visit folks that he knows and going from place to place. But he's doing quite well and is in good spirits, and thanks you for your prayers. Larry Hefner, on the other hand, is not doing well. The encouraging word we had last week was a bit premature. He's not getting stronger. He is getting weaker. He is often rather confused. The hematoma is probably putting pressure on the brain that's causing some of that. They're not sure what, if anything, can be done. They met with a neurologist on Wednesday who discussed one procedure that was possible that he could do that would relieve some of the pressure, but he wasn't positive it would help, and he says it could make it worse, which isn't something that doesn't sound like it's encouraging them to try it. He was supposed to go have a consultation with the oncologist on Thursday, but he had enough trouble just sitting upright long enough to see the neurologist on Wednesday. They didn't try to take him to another. No, that was the urologist he was to see on Thursday about his urinary tract infection. And so he didn't go, and now they're discussing whether they're going to take him in a stretcher to see them. He is just not able to get up and to get around. He's not doing well. Pray for them. Elaine is struggling with the decisions, and I think, well, she's pretty much at peace with the decisions. They've decided not to pursue any further action on the cancer. There's not any good route that has any promise of help without the likelihood of making things worse, and so they're not going to pursue any further work on the cancer. And they're not sure what to do about any of the rest of it. It is very unlikely he will ever go home again, right? And he's ready to go be with the Lord. And he's almost 83. He's tired of feeling this way, and he doesn't want to keep fighting. And they are pretty much reconciled to that, I think. So be praying for them for comfort and peace and for grace through what is a challenging time. Many of us have faced that with a parent or a spouse. And so you know kind of what they're going through. And try to be an encouragement. I think Elaine's biggest trouble is just fearing that people will think she's being awful and trying to play God. I said, no, you're just letting God be God. It's a decision that I think it's what I would want for me. So anyway, pray for them in these days. But I hadn't brought you up to date on that. And with that said, let's take just a moment. I'm going to ask Dr. Garland if you would lead us in prayer for that.
Heavenly Father, so many times we want to just ask why we can't be discouraged. The Lord, that we would just have given united heart, a heart that's focused on you, the word, and our eternal home, glory. And Father, as we go through these things, we see Austin getting better, see Larry, a different season of life. And Lord, we praise you for all the things you've done with Paul Whitaker, Nelly, and so many.
Amen. Well, for those who weren't here last week, I'll set the stage. And for those who were, just as a brief reminder, Daniel and his three faithful friends, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, are children of Judean nobility or even Judean royalty, probably between the ages of 14 and 16, so even literally children in many regards, although under their law they would be considered young adults at this point. They had been captured by the army of Babylon and taken as hostages to Babylon and have been placed in a 3-year program of training for service in Nebuchadnezzar's court. They're about halfway through that. It's the second year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, and so that would put them no more than halfway through, and maybe only in the first year of their training. Nebuchadnezzar has had a dream that has troubled him, and he knew it meant something important, or he assumed it meant something important, but he didn't understand it. And so he has assembled all the categories of his wise men, the representatives of all the groups of his wise men, and demanded that they tell him what it meant. But he wasn't sure he could trust, I think this is what's going on anyway, he wasn't sure he could trust that they wouldn't just make up some interpretation. And so he didn't tell them what he dreamed. He figured that if they could really communicate with spirits and divine mysteries, they should be able to tell him what he dreamed too. And so he insisted that they tell him his dream and then tell him what it meant. When they offered to interpret it for him, if he would just tell them what his dream was, he threatened to dismember them and destroy their households if they couldn't do what he said. But he promised them lavish, rich reward if they would do what he told them. Well, they knew they weren't capable of doing what he demanded, and so they accused the king of making an unreasonable demand that no human could fulfill. Only a god could do what you've demanded. A very interesting and important turn of phrase in their defense of themselves. Well, in frustrated fury, Nebuchadnezzar decided that his wise men, the whole bunch of them, were useless, and so he ordered the execution of all of them, including all of those guys still in training. Not any point in having these guys train more guys like them if they weren't any good. So just stop the whole program, defund the whole thing, and just get rid of a bunch of them. Daniel and his friends were among those to be executed, and they weren't a part of this whole conversation. They just get word, you're all going to die tomorrow, or whenever it was going to be. And so Daniel went to Arioch, the head of the school, the head of their training program, and asked him, what has prompted this? What made the king so angry that he's going to kill all of us? And Arioch explained to him what had happened. And so Daniel went to the palace, and the text indicates that he went to see the king. I'm not positive we have to read it that way, that he actually went in to see the king and asked the king to give them some time. He had refused to give his men additional time, and in fact accused them of just stalling for time in hopes he'd change his mind. And their request for time is what prompted the execution order. So I'm not sure that's what he's doing. I suspect what he may have done is gone to the palace and made an appointment to see the king and promised to be able to help. And then he went back and had a prayer meeting with his friends and asked God to intervene and to show them what he would if he would. And so they got together to pray for wisdom. God answered their prayer by revealing to Daniel what the king had dreamed and what it meant. And that's pretty much where we left off. Daniel and his friends got up from prayer, and the first thing they did is they composed a song. They sang a song of praise. I don't know how spontaneous that was, how much time they took. I suspect there was enough urgency in all of these events. They didn't take a long time. They composed this song a lot more quickly than I might have. But they sang this song of praise to God, recorded in verses 20 to 23. And then we see in verses 24 and following what happened next, beginning with verse 24. Therefore, Daniel went into Arioch, whom the king had appointed to destroy the wise men of Babylon. He went and spoke to him as follows. Do not destroy the wise men of Babylon. Take me into the king's presence, and I will declare the interpretation to the king. Then Arioch hurriedly brought Daniel into the king's presence and spoke to him as follows. I have found a man among the exiles from Judah who can make the interpretation known to the king. The king said to Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, are you able to make known to me the dream which I have seen and its interpretation? Daniel answered before the king and said, as for the mystery about which the king has inquired, neither wise men, conjurers, magicians, nor diviners are able to declare it to the king. However, there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries, and he has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will take place in the latter days. This was your dream and the visions in your mind while you were on your bed. Well, in this first section here, Daniel is reporting to the king. I think it's interesting that when he got up from prayer and finished his song, he did not immediately rush right to see the king. It's worth noting that what seems to have been his most urgent goal was not to deliver the message, but to stop the executions. You say, well, sure, that's because he and his friends would be executed. Daniel didn't go in and ask for him and his friends to be spared. If he just goes to Arioch and says, we've got the answer, take us to see the king, then he can go on, the executions can continue. He went, for one thing, by going in and stopping the executions, the first thing it demonstrates is Daniel's confidence. He's absolutely certain he has the answer. He knows that God has told him what the king dreamed. He doesn't have any questions. He's not saying, I've got an idea. I'm going to guess and see if the king will buy it. He knows what the king dreamed. He presumes that if the king really cares about what he dreamed, then he's going to recognize what he dreamed and this interpretation. And the king would recognize this as the truth. But this action, by going and immediately stopping the executions, going to Arioch and saying, don't kill anybody else, it also indicates Daniel's compassion. One thing Daniel knew about all these astrologers and sorcerers and soothsayers and magicians, one thing Daniel knew about all of them is they were practicing the occult and they were not following God. He knew that. Some of them were deluded, some of them were deceivers, and some of them were demonic. None of them were divine. Daniel would have been, it would have been justifiable for Daniel to go into Nebuchadnezzar and say, look, you may as well kill all of them, they're useless, we've got the answer. But he didn't do that. He demonstrated compassion on those unbelievers and asked that their executions be stopped. Once he delivered that message, look, we've got the solution. You don't have to kill anybody else. We can solve this. He immediately then went to told Arioch to take us in to see the king. Now, I don't know if Arioch was slated for execution too. He may have been as the head of this school, the head of this training program. But he was captain of the guard, and I suspect he's in charge of the executions and not one of those on the execution list. All right, I think he's one responsible for killing them all. It's going to look good on his resume if he can go into the king and say, look, I got a guy who can answer your question. Right? This will move him up in the estimation of the king. That may be part of his reason for walking in and say, I have found a man. It's not as if Arioch went looking and found this guy, right? There's a sense in which he seems to be taking credit for it, although that's not what I want to say here. It's probably more important that Arioch takes responsibility. It says a lot about Daniel's credibility in the eyes of Arioch that when Daniel says, we've got the answer, don't kill anybody else, take us to see the king, that Arioch walks in and says to the king, I got a guy here who can solve your problem. I have no idea what he's going to say. But he's going to tell you what you need to know. You understand, if Daniel fails, Arioch is doomed. Right? He put his life on the line for Daniel that day as he went in and took responsibility for it. It's unlikely Daniel could have gotten in to see the king other than his appointment that he had made, certainly not without this kind of an endorsement. And so Arioch, the head of the school, goes in and says, I got a guy here who's been under my charge, and he can tell you what you need to know. That's a bold, brave act for this man who was an unbeliever, but he's seen something in Daniel that he believed Daniel really could do what he claimed he could do. So Arioch takes responsibility. Part of the reason Arioch had to stand up for Daniel here may have been because of the need to justify the suspension of the executions. The king may want to know from Arioch, how come you haven't fulfilled my command and finished killing all these guys? Well, it's because I've got a guy who can answer this. So what happens once they get in there is Nebuchadnezzar questions Daniel. His name now is referred to as Belteshazzar. Again, he would be introduced to the king by his Babylonian name. And so that's why the name comes up again here. The purpose of the questions are really to put Daniel on the record. There would be a recorder there to take down anything that was said between the king and any of these people. There would need to be a witness to, kind of, it's kind of like going into court and swearing to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, and then being asked to state your name. They know your name; it's already, but it needs to be entered into the record from your lips. You need to tell them who you are. Well, he says to Daniel, can you tell me the dream? That's issue number one. It's a two-part question. Excuse me, phrased as one. But the first part of the question is really the most important one. Can you tell me the dream? That's the crux of the whole matter. A lot of the guys could promise to tell him the interpretation, but they couldn't tell him the dream. This has got to start here. Can you tell me the dream? And then, can you interpret the dream? And Daniel, in his answer, doesn't claim personal ability. He doesn't say, yeah, I got this all figured out, king. I have special insights. He points to God. Now, the text, he glorifies God, is how I put it in for the outline's sake, letter D. Daniel glorifies God. This text doesn't tell us all the stuff that's maybe going on in the background. This is a summary. Obviously, he's not writing down every little detail. So we don't know what Arioch said to Daniel about the king's conversation with his wise men the previous day, or earlier in the day, whenever it was. We don't know that whether Arioch gave him enough detail to realize that the Chaldeans had challenged the king and told him that he was a fool for demanding that they tell him the dream, because no man could do that, only a god could do it. Daniel's answer, though, reflects that language. It may be that he's intentionally reflecting that to point out that those guys understood that correctly. It may simply be providential that the wording of Daniel's answer so closely coincides with what was said in that earlier conversation between the king and the Chaldeans. First of all, Daniel asserts the impotence, the powerlessness of the wise men, their impotence. They can't tell you a thing. Those guys, the problem isn't that they're stupid. The problem is they were not capable of doing, nobody's capable of doing what you asked. You were asking them to do something that only God can do. He seems to be saying, don't blame them. No man can do what you ask. I can't even do it. But before you think I've bothered you for nothing, I know somebody who can do it. There is a God in heaven. Only a God could reveal this. I just happen to know the God. See, Nebuchadnezzar's problem was not that he'd sought help from the wrong people. His problem was that his people sought help from the wrong God. And they couldn't find an answer because they were looking in the wrong places. They weren't communicating with the one who knew the answer. And so after asserting the impotence of the wise men, he affirms the power of God. He affirms the power of God. He essentially gives God a new name here when he calls him the revealer of secrets. There is one who is a revealer of secrets, who is able to reveal mysteries. And I've come to deliver his message. And Daniel reveals that the dream concerns the latter days. The latter days. That's an important prophetic term. The latter days. It's similar to, but not identical with, a couple of other phrases. It is distinct from the last days for the church. I believe we are living in the last days during the church age. That does not mean I necessarily think Christ is coming back this spring, but he could. Nor does it necessarily mean that I believe Christ has to come back during this generation. I think it's likely, but every generation is supposed to be looking for Christ's return because we're living in the last days, awaiting his return and looking for his return. He hasn't told us to watch for signs of his coming. He's told us to watch for his appearing. And so we anticipate that he could come at any time because we live in those last days. That's not what this phrase means. That's not the same phrase. Latter days is not the same phrase. It's a broader than another expression Daniel will use in Daniel 11:35, the time of the end. The time of the end. That seems also to apply largely to the church age. But Daniel uses this term, latter days, and applies it to a time period that is actually beginning in his own generation, at his day, in his time, which would be approximately 600 BC. It spans from about 600 BC until Christ's second coming. That's the latter days. What he's saying is there is a time of the Gentiles that's beginning now, since Israel was taken, Judah now taken captive, a time of the Gentile ascendancy that's beginning now in about 600 BC. He doesn't use that term because that he wouldn't have had any frame for that term. But essentially with Nebuchadnezzar's ascension to power, the beginnings of the Babylonian Empire as Israel and Judah have fallen, it's now the time of the Gentiles, the Gentile dominance, that will continue until Christ returns. I believe Daniel is going to reveal that there is coming a time of 7 years of a new time for the Jews. God's dealing with the Jews in the last 7 years of the Gentile power under the false prophet and the beast prior to the establishment of Christ's kingdom here on earth. For 1,000 years. Daniel lays the framework for all of those things, and we'll look at that as we go. He doesn't do all that in this particular dream. All right. This dream gives a little bit of the scaffolding sort of for the next 600 years at least, leading up toward the second coming of Christ, a portion of which I don't think has been completely fulfilled yet. A portion of this dream I'm going to leave till next week. The latter days spans from about 600 BC until Christ's second coming, when Christ will come for the church and then come to establish his kingdom at the end of that period, his return to the earth to establish his millennial kingdom. Daniel has summarized all that. He hasn't given all that information, but when he says this is the latter days, that's what he's talking about. Now, revealing the dream, beginning with verse 29, Daniel actually does more than the king demanded. The king says, "Tell me my dream." Daniel says, "I'll tell you what was going on in your head before you started to dream and why you had the dream you had." Okay, that's more than the king asked for. He began by telling him why Nebuchadnezzar dreamed. It's not until after he's told him why he dreamed that he tells him what he dreamed, picking up in verse 31. But in verses 29 and 30, he says, "As for you, O king, while on your bed, your thoughts turned to what would take place in the future. And he who reveals mysteries," that's that new name for God, the revealer of mysteries, "he who reveals mysteries has made known to you what will take place. But as for me, this mystery has not been revealed to me for any wisdom residing in me more than in any other living man, but for the purpose of making the interpretation known to the king, and that you may understand the thoughts of your mind. The king had been lying in bed and unable to sleep. And here Daniel is not just telling him what he dreamed, he's telling him why he was upset, why he was distressed. You were sitting there, laying there in bed, unable to sleep because you were pondering the future. He was pondering the future. The king had enjoyed an incredibly successful first 2 years on the throne. He had been quite successful as a commander of the armies of Babylon while his father was on the throne, and now he's on the throne. And in a sense, kind of like later will happen with Alexander the Great, he may be wondering, okay, what do I do next? Everything is great. What could be better than this? What comes next? He might have even been wondering, is there any more to life than this? Often when someone reaches the pinnacle of what they can view as success in life, they find that life is still empty, and they begin to wonder if there's more to life than that. I've said frequently that I think that's what happened to Tiger Woods, that you get to the pinnacle and you find it's really not fulfilling. And that may be what was troubling Nebuchadnezzar. But for whatever it was, he was pondering the future, not sure what came next, wondering about what would come next. And the God, who is the revealer of mysteries, provided you some information in your dream. God provided information to show him what would happen. And Daniel makes it very clear that what I'm about to reveal to you, King, is not a testimony to my wisdom. This is not something I knew in myself, not something any man could know in himself. What happened is God wanted you to know something, and he sent me here to tell you what it is. Because of God's kindness to you, Nebuchadnezzar. God was showing him kindness. Now, what Nebuchadnezzar dreamed, verses 31 to 35. You, O king, were looking, and behold, there was a single great statue. That statue, which was large and of extraordinary splendor, was standing right in front of you, and its appearance was awesome. The head of that statue was made of fine gold. Its breast and its arms of silver, its belly and thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron and partly of clay. You continued looking until a stone was cut out without hands, and it struck the statue on its feet of iron and clay and crushed them. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold were crushed, and all at the same time, and became like chaff from the summer threshing floors, and the wind carried them away so that not a trace of them was found. But the stone that struck the statue became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. Okay. Well, if he's making it up, the king's going to know. Okay. This would be a tough sell as a dream if you hadn't actually dreamed this. This is what Nebuchadnezzar dreamed, a huge statue of a man. A huge statue of a man. The size of the statue is emphasized because it dwarfed Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar, who thought himself the giant who strode across history, is dreaming of something far greater. The point is that the events in which Nebuchadnezzar was living and the things that will happen later were much bigger, much more significant than Nebuchadnezzar himself. And that's part of what's troubling Nebuchadnezzar, because he was intimidated by this statue. But besides its immensity, the fact that it was a huge statue of a man, he describes it. The first impression of the statue is it was dazzlingly bright. Extraordinary splendor. Dazzlingly bright. And it was standing right in front of you. He didn't see it from a distance. And from up close, this thing was terrifying. Awesome. The word means terrifying. That word's been used so casually in our culture in a couple of recent decades that it has kind of drained it of any real meaning. If a cheeseburger can be described as awesome, then the word doesn't mean anything, okay? right? This thing inspired terror in the heart of Nebuchadnezzar, something Nebuchadnezzar would have been loath to admit. Maybe part of why he insisted his wise men tell him the dream rather than admit this. They need to be able to, only the spirits should be able to reveal that to them. But he was terrified by it. He cringed from before it. Then he describes the way this statue itself was composed or constructed, because it was strange. It wasn't all made of a single material. That's unusual. We see statues all the time. They typically are made of the same material. But this one wasn't. It was made of several different materials. Its head was gold. Its chest and arms were silver. Its abdomen and thighs were bronze. Its legs were, by the way, it's bronze, not brass. Bronze is an alloy of copper and tin. It's much better for weapons and armor because it's harder than brass. Brass is an alloy of copper and zinc. And this is the word for bronze that's used here. It was made of bronze, that portion of it, its abdomen and thighs. And then its legs were of iron, and its feet were partly of iron and partly of clay. And the clay is not raw clay, it's baked clay or even ceramic. It's a hardened clay, like a vessel, not the soft, malleable, unbaked clay. Anyway, strange list of materials, interesting reasons. And I've summarized it in number 3. It was made of materials diminishing in value. The fine gold at the head was by far the most valuable of the materials. Substantial diminution in value just by going to the silver, and then from silver to bronze, and from bronze to iron, and then the iron clay mix. It's getting much, much less valuable as you get closer to the ground. It's diminishing in value. It's also diminishing in weight. Of all of these substances, the gold was by far the heaviest. It was diminishing in weight. It's also increasing in hardness or brittleness in the case of the ceramic or tile. But the metals are softer the higher you go on the statue. And that, I think, has symbolic importance as well. For all that description, and anybody who is any kind of a builder, and Nebuchadnezzar certainly was, he was renowned as an architect and builder, perhaps even more so than Herod hundreds of years later. But anybody who knows anything about engineering or construction will tell you that if you build a statue like that, it's not going to stand up, or at least not for long. It's top heavy. With you don't put the heaviest material at the top and the lightest material at the base. It was confusing because it was top heavy and it was weak at the base with the clay mixed with the iron mixed with the clay. You want something this tall, this heavy. This kind of a colossus is going to need to stand on a pretty strong foundation. Just look at the Statue of Liberty. It is much lighter toward the top than it is toward the bottom because it's tapered toward the top. And then it stands on this huge pediment for its foundation. Nebuchadnezzar saw this freestanding statue that's top-heavy and weak at the bottom. This is kind of weird. And that's part of what's going to be going on in his head, because he was an engineer and an architect. Its feet and legs didn't provide an adequate foundation for the torso and head. If you manage to stand it up, its balance is going to be precarious. You might be able to get it to stand up, but you're probably going to need guy wires to hold it in place and everything else, because it's going to want to tip or tilt. Well, Daniel then revealed to the king that as he stood there examining this strange and confusing colossus, it was destroyed by a stone that was cut without hands from a mountain. The mountain's not actually mentioned until verse 45. He says it's cut without hands in this text. He describes it again in verse 45 as being cut out of the mountain. The stone that Nebuchadnezzar watched being hewn from the mountain without any visible stone cutters, I don't know how it got to the statue. Did it fly through the air? Did it roll down the mountain and smash into the image's feet? It doesn't say. But that stone was cut out, and then it came to the statue, and it struck the statue at its weak base, at its feet, and it collapsed And the whole thing shattered to powder and blew away so that not any trace of it could be found. Not any trace of it could be found. And then the stone that crushed the statue, the Colossus, grew into a mountain and filled the earth. Daniel concludes, this was the dream. Verse 36. This was the dream. Now we will tell its interpretation. If you're the king, you're probably sitting there just a little apprehensive, as well as stunned by this man's ability to reveal in detail, maybe details you hadn't fully remembered, but you remembered it in broad strokes. And Daniel tells him what the dream meant in verses 36 to 45. We will tell its interpretation before the king. You, O king, are the king of kings, to whom the God of heaven has given the kingdom, the power, the strength, and the glory. And wherever the sons of men dwell, or the beasts of the field, or the birds of the sky, he has given them into your hands and has caused you to rule over them all. You are the head of gold. So he says first that the golden head is Babylon, and specifically Nebuchadnezzar. Not just Babylon, but you are the one who has, it's you, Nebuchadnezzar, that has become that pinnacle of greatness in Babylon. You are the king of kings, the king to whom God has given authority over the earth. You say, now wait a minute, isn't that a title that God gives to Christ in the millennial kingdom? Yes, because the circumstances and situation change. Christ is the ultimate king over all kings. But at this time, in this context, in Daniel's world, Nebuchadnezzar was the king to whom all other kings gave obeisance. He was the king over kings on the earth in this period of the Gentile ascendancy, as it were. He attributes supreme human authority to Nebuchadnezzar. That's his point. Supreme human authority. Christ will later wield that ultimate authority visibly from his throne in the millennium. But at this moment in history, Nebuchadnezzar was the king. And he ruled all kings on the earth in a manner no other human king will, had or will, it seems. There will come a beast who will try, but even he will not be able to unite the earth. Granted, Nebuchadnezzar's world was more limited geographically. Nevertheless, his rule was as universal as it becomes, as it could be in his day. He says, you're the greatest king who's ever lived or whoever will live, is essentially what he's saying. But then he immediately makes a bold statement that anticipates the words of Christ before Pilate. When Jesus told Pilate, he said, you would have no power over me were it not given you from above. But Daniel attributes this power of Nebuchadnezzar's to a gift from God. He has given them into your hand. It's not because you're so powerful, but you're powerful because he gave it to you. Because God gave it to you. Nebuchadnezzar would immediately realize, when, as Daniel asserts his authority was a gift from God, Nebuchadnezzar would immediately realize that what Daniel is saying here is that Babylon's defeat of Israel was not due to the weakness of Israel's God, nor to the superiority of Marduk, as they had presumed. It was part of God's program for the ages in which Nebuchadnezzar was but a small player, an important one, yet still someone who was a tool in the hand of God. Nebuchadnezzar is a piece of the puzzle in God's hand. He is not the mover. He is not the puzzle maker. He is not even the mystery revealer. All right? There's a God who does all of these things. He is a part of God's program for the ages. And God's program for the ages, while it includes Nebuchadnezzar right now and his greatness, it's much bigger, much broader than Nebuchadnezzar in Babylon. Their role is temporary. Now, the silver and bronze parts are two empires to follow. After you, there will arise another kingdom inferior to you, then another third kingdom of bronze, which will rule over all the earth. He doesn't say much about them. These will be revealed later to be Medo-Persia and Greece. Medo-Persia and Greece, being of silver and bronze, respectively, means that their empires would be of inferior quality, but not narrower in scope. They were inferior in quality, but not in scope. They too would rule the earth. In fact, each of those kingdoms seems to expand the boundaries of their empire to encompass more territory, but with less and less grandeur under their authority. This is the Medo-Persian and the Greek empires. He'll say more about them in later. More about them will be revealed in later visions in Daniel. And Daniel will never name any of the kingdoms beyond those two. But the empire that followed Greece was the empire of Rome, and it was characterized by its iron weapons and its armor. And that's implied in this next one. There will be a fourth kingdom as strong as iron, inasmuch as iron crushes and shatters all things. So, like iron that breaks in pieces, it will crush and break all these in pieces. In that you saw the feet and toes, partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, it will be a divided kingdom, but it will have in it the toughness of iron, inasmuch as you saw the iron mixed with common clay. As the toes of the feet were partly iron and partly pottery, so some of the kingdom will be strong and part of it will be brittle. And in that you saw the iron mixed with common clay, they will combine with one another in the seed of men, but they will not adhere to one another, even as iron does not combine with pottery. In the days of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which will never be destroyed, and that kingdom will not be left for another people. It will crush and put an end to all these kingdoms, but it will itself endure forever, inasmuch as you saw that a stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, and that it crushed the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold. The great God has made known to the king what will take place in the future, so the dream is true and its interpretation trustworthy. All right, what comes following the silver and bronze empires of Medo-Persia and Greece is an iron empire that is understood to represent Rome. Now, he stresses the strength of the iron because more than any before it, this kingdom would possess the power to break in pieces. Rome had the power to crush, the power to impose its will more strongly than the other empires have been able to do, the power to subdue all opponents. And both of those descriptions accurately describe Rome. And finally, there would come a kingdom represented by feet of iron and clay. And I'm going to tell you tonight that we'll deal with that one next week. Sorry. These others are easy because they've already happened. The last stage, I don't think, has been fulfilled yet, or it's in the process of being fulfilled. Okay? And there are various views on how the feet of iron mingled with clay should be understood. And I'm going to tell you a couple of different views and tell you some of their strengths and weaknesses. Ironically, since iron and clay has strengths and weaknesses, these views have strengths and weaknesses as well. But I don't believe that portion of this vision has yet been fulfilled completely. I think it's yet to be fulfilled. And the destruction of that final form, with that stone that will destroy it so that all parts of it blow away and no trace can be found. We certainly aren't living in that day today. That is yet future. And we'll talk about that next time as well as we get to the conclusion of this. I need more than 5 or 6 minutes. And I could have gone a little quicker here and covered it, but I needed more than 10 also. So I just decided to save all that for next time. All right. The fact that the head of gold is the only unified segment in this statue. Every other segment has some form of division. The silver one is the Medo-Persian, the arms. The legs of bronze in the Greek Empire. The thighs of bronze, I should say. The legs of iron in the Roman Empire. There is incremental decentralization of authority. that's implied. When you get down to the feet and toes being mentioned, this isn't a statue that is shod. Often a statue is wearing boots or something, and you wouldn't have the toes being distinguished. This statue had visible toes. And there's a reason for that, I think, pointing to continuing decentralization of authority. There's a diminishing of value of materials, I think, that indicates the degeneration of humanity and the increasing depravity of human government that we can witness to as we trace history. contrary to evolutionary theory or sociological theory, humanity is not getting better. Humanity is getting worse. Humans are treating one another with increasing brutality. The increasing military strength implied by the iron, as well as the employment of additional brutality to enforce law, we are seeing in various parts of the world today too. I think we're seeing the fulfillment of it, but it hasn't been completed yet. We're seeing it progressing toward fulfillment, and we'll talk more about that next time. All right. But in all of this, what we see most of all is that God has a plan. And he has a program, and things are working according to his plan and his program. And we don't need to be terrified about what's going on. We may not always be comfortable, and some of these transitions from empire to empire have been less than comfortable for the people under their rule. We don't need to be afraid that God is not in charge. None of those empires have ever truly been in charge. They are all a part of an image God built and that he will destroy when the time comes. Let's pray. Father, we thank you for the confidence that we have in you as our sovereign King. We look forward to the day when Christ himself will be King of kings and Lord of lords and rule with absolute authority over the whole world. In Jesus' name, amen.